Good afternoon. This is Bob Krueger with Thought for Food for August of 2023. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m., repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, but hopefully it'll be of interest to everyone. August is the only month of the year without a federal holiday, but has several dates to remember. The first is Air Force Day, and on the 4th we learn that the United States Coast Guard was established in 1790. The Purple Heart Medal was established in 1782 on the same day. And on the 14th, Japan surrendered, ending World War II. The 14th is also National Navajo Code Talkers Day. The 19th is National Aviation Day. And 26th is Women's Equality Day. My stepson's birthday is the 2nd. Do you have trouble falling asleep? It can be really hard to find motivation to get a workout in or make it to the gym after a long, exhausting day at the office. But studies have shown that exercising in the evening can aid sleep. Newsweek magazine spoke with two fitness experts to find out exercises that they recommend people squeeze into their evening routines and why they are effective in supporting a good night's sleep. Sports medicine expert and board-certified orthopedic surgeon at the Spine Pro in Beverly Hills, Dr. Hussman Malamed, argues that if a busy person wants to squeeze a bit of exercise before bed, they should choose anything that raises their heart rate. Aerobic exercises like a brisk walk, jogging, cycling, or swimming for 30 to 40 minutes have shown to regulate the sleep cycle, he said. Also, moderate intensity aerobic activity can also lead to a good night's rest. The sports medicine expert said that individuals who should aim to get these exercises in at least 3 or 4 times a week to create a consistent pattern for measurable results. Certified personal trainer Rose McNulty agreed that heart rate boosting cardiovascular exercise is the way to go in the evening. The expert panel's Garage Gym Reviews, which provides in-depth and honesty on everything fitness-related, research suggests that exercise and good sleep go hand in hand, the type of exercise you often see are recommended cardiovascular training. If you have trouble sleeping, burning energy in the form of cardio is one way you might be able to improve your sleep, she added. Ms. McNulty also recommended that individuals opt for a spot of yoga or stretching before their head hits the pillow. Yoga and stretching are different activities, but both have the potential to improve your sleep in similar ways, she said. Both yoga and stretching put a focus on breathing, which can have a relaxing effect and help you wind down before bed. Research has also found yoga to be beneficial to sleep in older adults and women. These latter activities promote relaxation, help reduce muscle tension, and help you unwind. When you exert yourself through intense exercise, your body releases energy, leading to fatigue. This fatigue can help reduce the time it takes for you to sleep. However, the orthopedic surgeon warns against exercising too close to bedtime because that can reduce the production of melatonin in a person's body, making it harder to fall asleep. Your body starts to produce melatonin toward the end of the day, and when you work out too late, your body is also producing adrenaline, which it needs for exercises. This can be problematic because it tends to send to your brain, which is why you're having a hard time sleeping after a late workout. There's a truce in the Taco Tuesday wars. Restaurant chain Taco John said it is giving up its fight, defending its trademark Taco Tuesday. Fast food giant Taco Bell filed a petition in May with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office seeking to cancel the trademark. Taco Tuesday is generic, and any restaurant that makes tacos should be able to use it, Taco Bell said. Jim Creel, Chief Executive Officer of Taco John's, which operates nearly 400 restaurants in more than 20 states, said the company estimated it would cost as much as $1 million to defend the trademark. It's just not worth that amount of money it would take to defend it. We would rather take the money and put it to a good cause. Mr. Creel said Taco John's will donate $40,000 to the Children of Restaurant Employees, a nonprofit group that provides financial support to people who work in the restaurant industry and have children. Mr. Creel said he hoped Taco Bell will consider giving a donation to the group as well. Taco Bell turned the Taco Tuesday dispute into a marketing campaign. It enlisted enthusiast and NBA star LeBron James, who shot a commercial for Taco Bell calling for the liberation of Taco Tuesday. Mr. James said he also tried to trademark Taco Tuesday in 2019, but the trademark office denied it, saying it was a commonplace phrase. Taco John's has owned the trademark on Taco Tuesday since 1989 in every state except New Jersey. Gregory's Restaurant and Bar in the New Jersey shore town of Summers Point owns the trademark in New Jersey. Taco Bell filed a petition in May seeking to cancel Gregory's trademark as well. Greg Gregory, whose family owns Gregory's, said in June the restaurant would attempt to defend its trademark. Any restaurant in the U.S. except New Jersey can legally use Taco Tuesday now that Taco John's has given up defending its trademark. Dave Olson, who ran a Taco John's franchise in St. Paul, Minnesota, first started offering Taco Tuesdays in 1979. He originally called it Taco Tuesday, and that was T-W-O-S-D-A-Y. The Taco Tuesday concept spread to other Taco John locations during the 1980s. Mr. Creel credited Taco Tuesday for driving the success of Taco John's throughout the Midwest. He said it's tough for Taco John's to give up his trademark. It's a sad day for us and a lot of our customers. But at the same time, we still get to have Taco Tuesdays, and others will have Taco Tuesday as well. Even as more and more parents heed the message to avoid added sugar, they end up reaching instead for products crammed with artificial ingredients. These snacks and drinks often have a healthy veneer, advertising they are low sugar or only half the sugar of previous formulas. The only indication that they contain sugar alcohols that are chemical sweeteners may be the long list of ingredients on the back side of the container. The goal of reducing sugar in kids' diets is a noble one in a country where obesity tripled in the early 1970s to about 1 in 5 children. But experts worry that parents might be swapping one evil for another, selecting ultra-processed products loaded with additives that haven't been extensively researched in children. In July, a panel of the World Health Organization declared aspartame a possible carcinogen, 40 years after it was first approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. I think we're embarking on a huge experiment with no control group and including kids without parental consent, said Walter Willett, a professor of epidemiology and nutrition at Harvard University School of Public Health. Today, there are dozens of sweeteners in the U.S. food supply, some of which were developed in the past few years. Consumers might struggle to find a snack or a drink marketed to kids that's sweetened with sugar anymore. Food manufacturers say they're responding to increased parent demand for sugar-free and low-sugar products and are abiding by federal guidelines. We know that some consumers are interested in sugar-free food, so we look for solutions that will deliver on taste and comply with FDA regulations, said Dan Hare, a spokesman for Conagra Brands, parent company of Snack Pack. Providing a multivitamin with key essentials to support kids in forms and flavors that kids will enjoy taking is important to our consumers, says Nicole Hayes, the director of U.S. External Communications with Flintstone Vitamins Parents Company, Bayer. Food safety over the long haul is hard to study because researchers can't control a subject's diet over decades, and testing on kids gets even thornier. This has led to dramatic swings in nutrition guidelines over the years. The surge of low sugar and no sugar products isn't a function of changing consumer preferences. Many of us are no longer working, not for a salary anyway. For those who still are, here are some interesting news. Findings from one of the largest experiments with a four-day work week offers new ballast for people hoping to adopt this schedule. The longer people worked in new, more efficient ways, the shorter their work weeks became. Results came from a series of four-day work weeks conducted in the U.S., Canada, England, and Ireland over the past 18 months. Dozens of companies, ranging from design agencies to manufacturers and nonprofits, tested the four-day concept, an approach that is gaining traction as employers and employees rethink the traditional ways of work. Workers were given a paid day off a week, but the same workload to see whether they could get as much work done working more efficiently. After 6 months, workers said they had less burnout, improved health, and more job satisfaction, and had cut their average work time by about 4 hours to 24 hours a week. Those who continued to schedule a full 12 months reduced working times even further to about 33 hours a week, researchers say. Meanwhile, they continue to report better mental and physical health and work-life balance. The idea of working less than the conventional 40 hours over 5 days has been kicked around for years, but has found more momentum recently. Some employers and policymakers are exploring whether a four-day work week can improve employee well-being and loyalty and help them compete for workers. Up to now, most studies of four-day weeks examine the short-term effects. The new findings are the first that looked across multiple companies over a longer 12-month period. They suggest that business and employees both benefit in the long run as workers get accustomed to shorter weeks, companies and researchers say. Most companies don't ask workers to speed up and cram 5 days of tasks into fours, said Juliet Shore, an economist and sociologist at Boston College, whose team helped conduct the study with nonprofit advocacy group 4 Day Week Global. Instead, they reduced meetings and dedicated more time to uninterrupted focus work, she said. The mass majority of jobs are likely to stick to the conventional 5 day schedule for the foreseeable future. Most companies trying shorter weeks are small employers, and some workers in 4 day experiments report struggling to get everything done at the same time. Janice Yohara, chief executive and co-owner of Search Engine Journal, a digital marketing publication that participates in one of the U.S. trials, said she proposed moving to a four-day week last year. Some of the company's 36 remote employees had become overwhelmed with the increase in work and the turnover was rising. As a part of an experiment, the company declared a meeting bankruptcy, wiping out all meetings from the calendar for a month, then thinking about which were really necessary. Within 6 months, the company's turnover had dropped, productivity held up, and clients didn't notice the business had moved to a four-day week. The company plans to continue on 4 day week with staff taking off on Fridays. It seems as if the Triangle is a place that many restaurants and food companies want to be located. Among them is the news that a new Greek restaurant has opened last month in Durham's Brightleaf Square. Nikos, a new Greek and Mediterranean restaurant from Giorgio Bektassis, is located at 915 West Main Street in Durham. This restaurant is first to open in Brightleaf Square in years, as the historic Durham Shopping Center has seen ownership changes and numerous closings as well as new project announcements. Mr. Bactasis has been one of the most influential forces in the Triangle dining scene for a couple of decades, and over the past few years has been on a furious pace of openings. In the last year, he has opened Krill, Las Rambas, Giorgio Pizza Bar, and East End Bistro, as well as a Wilmington outpost of his popular Greek Taverna Kipos. Years ago, while still in his original restaurant heyday, Brightleaf hosted an earlier Bactasis restaurant called Taverno Nico. He says the Nikos will pay homage to the history, but will build on the tastes of today. In a new release, Mr. B said, "We're excited to revive a restaurant in Brightleaf Square. We're involving our original concept in response to the neighborhood today, which has flourished and become very multicultural. We'll be exploring the wonderful overlap of rich cuisines from Greek to surrounding Eastern Mediterranean companies and look forward to honoring them in this historic building." Mr. B is a bit poetic at times. A New York-based burger brand just opened its first North Carolina location in Raleigh. Burger Village opened on Glenwood Avenue last month, debuting as the brand's first location outside New York and California. Started in 2013, Burger Village is an organic take on the burger bar and includes a wide variety of game meats on its everyday menu. They have six locations in New York City and one in California. The owner of the Raleigh location is Shalini Bahatia, who held the restaurant's grand opening June 23rd at 510 Glenwood Avenue in the middle of the city's nightlife district. Their menu offers more than a dozen burgers, hitting on the classic beef with a thicker patty than most burgers. They also have meat options like elk, bison, ostrich, boar, and chicken burgers. Snacks include fried zucchini, onion rings, and tots. USA Today readers voted two North Carolina ice cream shops as among the best ice cream shops in America. The annual 10 Best Reader's Choice Awards are determined by readers' votes. Initial selections come from travel experts choosing the top 10 nominees in a number of categories, including Best Art Museum, Best Farmer's Market, Best Outdoor Water Parks, and more. All categories and winners can be found at 10best.com/awards/travel. USA Today readers voted two North Carolina ice cream shops as some of the best in the nation, with shops in Triangle getting top scores. The annual 10 Best Choice Awards are determined by reader votes. Andia's Ice Cream and Kerry came in fourth on the list. That's fourth in the country. They've been voted the best ice cream in the Triangle last summer. "It's not a trend that's going to come and go. Everybody loves ice cream," said Andia Zoris. Her flavors of the month include Bite Me, Birthday Cake, Thai Tea, Malted Twix, Freckled Mint, Summer Blues, and Buttered Beer. Andia's small batch premium quality ice cream offers appealing flavors. Monster shakes that come in mason jars are frequent stars. USA Today's Best 10 said, "You can visit Andrea's homemade ice cream at 10,120 Green Level Church Road and 1008 Ryan Road, both in Cary. An additional location will open later this year in Raleigh's Ironworks Department. Two Reese's Ice Cream Shop won eighth place nationally in USA Today's 10 Best Ice Cream Shop contest. Two Roosters began in March of 2015 out of a turquoise and white camper attached to an old Ford F-100 truck, selling homemade ice cream and some unexpected flavors. Think grilled cheese and pizza. Today they scoop in five locations, three in Raleigh, two in Durham, including at the Durham Bills Athletic Park. They still use the original pickup truck and trailer. To me, it's like, how can we take these classic things that people are used to and tweak them just slightly so they're still familiar but yet different from the next person down the street," said co-owner Jared Plummer, an NC State graduate. "One of my favorite things is that when people try a flavor and it's unlike everything they've had. North Carolina's Two Roosters promises it will offer forever flavors like double fold vanilla and coffee bourbon, while monthly specials are equally tempting. You can visit Two Roosters at 7713 Leadmine Road in Raleigh, 215 Franklin Street in Raleigh, 4025 Lake Boone Trail in Raleigh, 800 Trailer Street in Durham, and at the ballpark at the Bulls' home games. It's too bad that salt tastes so good is the title of an article that appears in the Wall Street Journal earlier this year. The author is B. Wilson, and her B is spelled with two E's, whose food articles appear under the title Table Talk. She begins, "Eating less salt would make most people healthier. The trick is finding ways to reduce our intake without sacrificing deliciousness. Like most food writers, when I hear a nutritionist suggest that we eat too much salt, I tend to put my fingers in my ears and think passionately about anchovies. Salt is not another ingredient. As Canadian food writer Naomi Gugoid writes in her new cookbook, The Miracle of Salt, it's as familiar as water in the air we breathe and just as essential to us. Salt is the only thing that can make a tomato both juicier, because it draws out the liquid, and sweeter, because it suppresses the tomato's bitterness. Salt's the tang in an olive and the crispness in a dill pickle. When I cook pasta, I want the water to be as salty as the sea, or my tears, depending on how the day is going. So it gives me no pleasure to admit that nutritionists are right. When you dig into the science of salt and diets, it's impossible to deny that eating less salt really would improve the health of millions of people. In many cases, even prevent death from high blood pressure. Hypertension, that is known as high blood pressure, now kills more people every year than tobacco. According to the New York Journal of Medicine, there would be 1.65 million fewer deaths around the world every year if salt consumption was lowered to the World Health Organization's recommended limit of 5 grams a day, the equivalent of a teaspoon of fine salt. Currently, the average American eats a teaspoon and a half. We know that reducing salt works, said Dr. Sonia Pombo, a public health nutritionist who is the lead campaigner for the British charity Action on Salt. From 2003 to 2011, English food companies voluntarily agreed to reduce the salt in their product without letting the consumers know. In that period, the number of deaths from stroke fell 43%. The reason it works so well is that in the United Kingdom, as well as in the U.S., the vast majority of the sodium people consume is away from home. Much of the salt is well hidden. We're not even aware of consuming it. Take breakfast cereals. Many brands, including Corn Flakes and Rice Krispies, contain more than a half a gram of salt per recommended serving. The tricky question is where the salt in home cooking fits in. As someone who cooks every day and eats very little processed food, I honestly believe that the sea salt I sprinkle is different from the salt hidden in packaged snacks. As Miss Dugoid shows in her delightful book, salt is a key element in traditional cuisines around the world and serves many functions aside from the obvious one of making food taste salty. Because it's an antibacterial agent, salt is a critical ingredient in most pickles, from preserved lemons of the Middle East to the kimchi of South Korea. Salt, she writes, also stimulates the sensors in our taste buds, enabling us to experience subtle flavors that might go undetected. And then I came across the story of salt in Japan. In the 1950s, the Japanese had some of the highest rates of death from stroke in the world. Japanese salt consumption was also extremely high, an average of 18 grams a day in the north of the country, most of it coming from traditional foods used in home cooking, such as miso and soy sauce. A government campaign successfully reduced salt intake to 12.1 grams a day by the 1960s. At the same time, there was an astonishing 80% decline in deaths from stroke, and a drop in blood pressure in both adults and children. The Japanese example proved that too salty cooking is a problem, at least for those who are prone to high blood pressure. And as Ms. Pombo told me, 7 out of 10 people who have high blood pressure don't even know they have it. For those of who love cooking with salt but absolutely do not want to have a stroke, what's the answer? One thing is to consider is potassium. The ratio between potassium and sodium in our diet plays a crucial role in regulating blood pressure. I recently came across one of those most remarkable salts I ever tasted. It's called sertani, which means salt of the earth in Malagasy, because that's what it is. As the anthropologist Alison Richard wrote in her book, The Sloth Lemur's Song, women in Madagascar scrape up salty soil, mix it with water, strain it through reed mats, and cook it for hours in open pans. The resulting salt has a beautiful, gentle, clean flavor, as much higher in potassium than other salts. Madagascans consider it as a healthy salt for those with high blood pressure. It's sold in Europe as Madagascan bourbon salt by a small spice company called Steenbergs, although they don't ship to the United States. If you can't lay your hands on any sertani, you can follow Madagascan's example and add more potassium to your diet to counteract the salt. A 2018 study of more than 400 Americans found that following a diet rich in fruits, vegetables, and low-fat dairy, all of which are high in potassium, helped to lower blood pressure, even when combined with a relatively high-sodium diet. Foods that are high in potassium include sweet potatoes, spinach, black beans, yogurt, and bananas. It's also possible to cultivate a less palate. When the late food writer Lori Colvin was forced to go on a salt-free diet for health reasons, she found that her tastes changed so much she started to appreciate the flavors of food more without salt. I have no intention of giving up salt just yet, but I found that a recipe calls for 1 teaspoon of salt. You can get away with a half teaspoon plus a squeeze of lemon juice or a dash of vinegar. I never thought I would say this, but sometimes food tastes better and brighter with less salt and more. We can often learn a lot from informed food writers. Thank you again, Miss Wilson. Mrs. Wilson, when supermarkets were first introduced, they were a disruptive concept, putting general stores, butchers, and greengrocers and bakers out of business. Is it now time for them to fade away? In 1930, a former Kroger employee introduced the concept of a large store with separate food departments and discount pricing. Supermarkets expanded with suburbia and car ownership. They went from 35% of retail sales in 1950 to 70% in 1960, according to Progressive Grocer, a trade publication. These days, competition for food dollars have grown, both from formats that compete on value, such as Costco and Walmart. Another format growing in popularity is a smaller discount grocer typified by Aldi and Lidl. We've run out of time for today's episode of Thought for Food. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Bob Kruger reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138.